Next case on our calendar, 02-2032, State of Ohio versus Grady Brinkley. Justice Lanzinger has recused herself from this case, and we're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Lanzinger. Judge Lynn Slaby is the judge of the Court of Appeals sitting in the 9th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Slaby. Mr. Gamzo.
Good morning. I'd like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal, if I might. May it please the court, Mr. Anderson. We have 24 propositions of law, and I'm not intending, of course, to discuss all 24 of them, or even most of them. I want to begin with the 6th. Juror number 52, a typical juror who has qualms, said, "I will follow the law," said, "I don't really like the death penalty. I will have a hard time voting for it. I can't quite think of circumstances. But I will follow the law, whatever the law is, I will follow the law." The state asks that juror, "Well, are you going to say death?" And he says, "Well, you know, based on what I know right now, I'd say no, but I expect to learn more." "Will you follow the law?" says the defense. "Yes, I will follow the law," she says. I assume it's a she. Yes. Finally, after this back and forth, which is the sort of thing we see all the time, finally the court speaks to the juror. And the judge says this. He says, "You say you can't imagine any set of circumstances. If the law said that if another individual took a life of somebody else while committing a felony, another felony of sorts, and the law said under those circumstances the penalty of death is the appropriate penalty, are you telling me that if that was presented to you, that's not the kind of circumstances where you would vote to impose the death penalty?" And the juror says, "I don't believe so. Wouldn't do it." And the judge says, "Well, I'm going to excuse this juror for cause," does that over objection. "I'm going to excuse this juror for cause because I gave her a hypothetical that's just like the facts of this case, and she said she can't impose death." And the judge is wrong. The judge is wrong up, down, and sideways. First of all, the hypothetical is not like the facts of this case, although it touches on some of them. Second of all, the hypothetical is clearly, plainly wrong as a legal matter. Under those circumstances that the judge set forth before this juror, the only possible verdict, except for the part where the judge said you have to vote for death under these circumstances, the only possible verdict under Ohio law would be life. Here's what the judge left out. He said, "It's a felony murder, and therefore you have to vote death." Well, that's not Ohio law. That's not, to get to be death penalty felony murder, we have a limited number of felonies. We have the aggravated murder that is caused purposely. We have issues of prior calculation and design. We have death specifications. We have, was he a principal? Did he act with prior calculation and design if this is a felony aggravated murder?
But Mr.
And then
Gamzo,
we have.
Excuse me, Mr. Gamzo, the question you left out at the end of that colloquy was, even if the law required it, and she answered she would not vote for the death penalty even if the law required it, which sort of is the recap of what you're telling us now as the colloquy between the court and that prospective.
Yes, she does say that. She does say that. But when you tell somebody, and here we have the basic problem that we have in all jury situations, right? Will you follow the law, whatever it might be? And we ask the jury, understandably, we say to the jury, we want you to say yes. We want jurors who will follow the law, whatever that law might be, even if they disagree with it. But when we go and we're trying to determine if this juror, the question that is properly before the court, is this juror's attitude such that they cannot fairly follow the law? If the test is, I'm going to give you something that's not the law, something that sets up death in a circumstance far more likely than the law ever allows, where there is far less to support death than the law demands before death is a possibility, let alone a certainty. And then I'm going to tell you that under those circumstances, you must vote for death. Would you do that? Would you vote for death if somebody robs somebody? That's the question. If the answer is no, yes, the person may be saying, I won't follow the law if you tell me what that's what the law is, but that's so grossly different, and it is more grossly different than this, I understand. But that's so grossly different from what the actual law is that we can't say that's a fair question, and that's a fair basis for exclusion. On the facts, what
well,
we
counsel-
have is yes.
At that time, she didn't know what the law was.
No.
And the judge didn't say that, you know, this is identical to the situation you're going to encounter. Presumably, a juror is instructed on what the law is. So it's not material that the judge would instruct what the law is during voir dire and ask, can you follow that situation?
No, I'm not suggesting the judge should do that. I'm sorry, if I made that suggestion, then I misspoke myself, because that was not my intent. It's not my suggestion that the judge should, during voir dire, tell the jury, this is the law, these are the circumstances, this is what you must find, this is what you can't find, this is what you have to do, these are the this is all the detail here, now will you do that under these circumstances if A, B, C, D, and E? I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying is that in this case, that's what the judge tried to do. That's a decision he made. It is probably, maybe, within the judge's discretion to say, in an individual case, I'm going to give you more information than we ordinarily do, to help me figure out whether you are somebody who would be so impaired that you cannot fairly sit on this jury. When the information that the judge gives, as in this case, when the information so understates the state's burden in seeking death, says, under these circumstances, which are, without telling the juror that, vastly less than the things which would otherwise have to be proved before death would even be a possibility, under these circumstances, would you give death if you had to, if I told you you had to? And the juror says, well, no, that I wouldn't do. And the judge says, well, since that's like this case, and if you wouldn't do that, then you can't do it. The truth is, that's not like this case. And it's not a fair test of this juror to say, I'm going to give you a hypothetical that's completely wrong, that understates the burdens, and if you can't meet that, then you don't qualify. The juror said, from what I know now, this is what she kept saying, from what I know now, I couldn't vote for death. If I expect to know more after the trial.
The judge did say, I think, that, again, that the law required the death penalty. Would you sign your name on a verdict form? And she said to them, to be honest, I can't imagine anything at this point that would make me go in that direction. Isn't that a clear sign that here's a juror who just simply does not agree with the death penalty, or at least she doesn't want to be a part of putting someone to death? And, you know, the discretion of the trial judge here.
She's got qualms. Certainly she has qualms. How far those qualms are. The problem is we know how the judge is exercising his discretion because he tells us. He says, I'm taking you off this jury. I am granting the state's challenge for cause of this juror because of her answer to my hypothetical. That's what he says. He tells us that. And that's just wrong. I kind of want to move on from this, if I might. And just kind of remember here, and I'm not suggesting that I think I'm wrong. I think I'm absolutely right about this. But what I want to do is I want to take from this a lesson, too, to apply elsewhere. And the lesson is that what the judge is putting forth here is not, in fact, is not even particularly close to an accurate statement of Ohio's capital sentencing scheme. Now, this is also not the final jury charge. I understand that. I want to go back now and talk about the first assignments of error, if I might. First assignment of error deals with the A3 specification that was attached to both counts of aggravated murder, single victim, two counts. The A3 specification was attached to both that the aggravated murder was committed for purposes of escaping, detection, apprehension, trial, or punishment. I want to suggest, actually I want to say rather forcefully, that the state didn't even come close to proving that. Now, here's what it seems to me the evidence shows, and shows read most generously in favor of the state. But a couple of months before the killing of Shante Smith, Grady Brinkley was arrested and charged with the robbery of the City Diner in Toledo, Ohio. That he spent that time in the county jail, that Ms. Smith, his girlfriend, took up with another man, one Lamont Petaway, while he was in that county jail, that he learned about that while he was in the county jail, that he told, and again, I'm not saying I necessarily think all this is true, but this is what the evidence, there is evidence to say all these things, that he told an inmate in the county jail, jailhouse snitch, that that he was going to kill Shante Smith because she took up with Lamont Petaway, that at his urging, Shante Smith bailed him out of jail, arranged for his bond, that he then did kill her, that he then took from her an ATM card after he'd killed her, attempted to get money out of her account with the ATM card, and that he then fled to Chicago. That's the state's evidence. What it comes down to is he killed, and what the evidence shows, and what it seems to me the argument was in this case to the jury, is that he killed Shante Smith for exactly the reason, if he did, and we actually dispute that he did that in the first place, but if you buy it that he did, that he killed her for exactly the reason that the jailhouse snitch said he was going to. He killed her because she'd taken up with another man.
Except there is also a hearing on the 6th. He did not show up, and he departs on the 7th, which he skipped town.
Yeah. No question. So, he left town.
And he didn't show up for the hearing, so he wasn't intending to stay.
He did not show up for the hearing the day before.
Right.
The day before her, what appears to be the day of her death, yes.
Okay.
That's right.
Counsel, in that regard, was there a suggestion that the bond money was actually the missing funds from the robbery?
It floats through as a possibility.
Was that presented to the jury?
Yes.
That he had given her?
He gave her some of the proceeds from the robbery, yes.
And she put those in?
Presumably.
Yeah. A couple thousand bucks in.
The timing is right, and the, yes.
Is pretty unusual, I suppose.
She was his girlfriend. She was working with him on this. You know? Here's the question. Do those facts, as I recited that evidence, I think it's a pretty fair statement of the evidence, although I'm sure the state will tell you the things I left out. As I recited those facts, it seems clear that if you believe all those things, he is, in fact, he can be found guilty of the aggravated murder of Ms. Smith, purposeful killing, and accompanying the killing, a robbery. He took her ATM card, he took her jacket.
Counsel, why are they mutually exclusive? That he would kill her because they were on the outs over a relationship that has soured thanks to another man, and geez, now that she's not on my side anymore, I better do away with her because it'll facilitate my ability to leave town. I'll use the money that, who knows, I may or may not have given her that's sitting in that bank account. I'll access it. She won't give it to me voluntarily. I need to get it. I mean, I don't see the mutual exclusivity here.
Well, okay, as a theoretical proposition, they could come together. What I'm suggesting is that there's actually no evidence that they do come together. You're right in the sense that the state's claim, at least in its briefs, is that he killed her in order to rob her to get the money to get out of town. That's the state's claim in this court. And what I want to suggest is that, in theory, one could do that. That's not an impossible it's not an impossible scenario to imagine. What I'm suggesting is that the evidence in this case simply doesn't support that. There is, in fact, no evidence. There is evidence of a purpose to kill. There is evidence of a purpose to rob. Or there is evidence to support a purpose to kill. There is separate evidence to support a purpose to rob. There is, what I would suggest, is no evidence except the propinquity of those two events to suggest that the purpose to rob was part of, somehow related to, the purpose to kill. There is no evidence that they had anything to do with each other. I want to kill her. Separately, I'd kind of like to rob her. And I want to rob her so I can get to Chicago. Okay, aggravated robbery is for purposes of escaping apprehension, detection, trial, punishment. Aggravated murder, on the other hand, in this case, on these facts, yeah, we could make up a hypothetical where it was different, but on these facts, the evidence simply doesn't support I killed her in order to rob her. There's just no evidence of that here. If that's right, then the question is, what happens next? What follows from that? And here's what I think follows from that. First, the severance motions that were made repeatedly, the severance motions to separate out the robbery of the city diner into a separate trial from this trial, on the basis that her aggravated murder ultimately had nothing to do with those severance motions, which were properly denied given this death specification, they had to be denied. Of course the evidence of the city diner robbery had to come in, because that's what he was, according to the specification, seeking to escape detection for. But if the specification is a sham, if the specification is as we maintain and have been maintaining all along, if the specification is there simply as an excuse to have gotten in, and we don't know what's in the grand jury testimony, I have to say that. We don't know how this case was presented to the grand jury because we don't have the grand jury testimony. But if the specification is there as an excuse to work in the evidence of the city diner, to say the city diner crime comes in now because it's part of this, because we got to prove the specification and the city diner robbery is part of the specification. If that's the reason, then what I want to suggest is that, and it was a brutal robbery. It was a brutal robbery. It's a terrible crime. And there's no question about it being Grady Brinkley. The evidence of that is absolutely clear. But if that's so, then what we'd suggest is the evidence of the city diner was brought in. Or the specification is there, not to have another death specification that has any legs, but rather as an excuse to bring in the evidence of the city diner crime.
Well, counsel, her relationship with Mr. Brinkley took a turn for the worse, according to Mr. Brinkley, while he was in jail, awaiting. How would you explain his presence in jail and the connectivity between the bail money and the victim here? That all would have come in.
I don't know that it does, but certainly the details of the city diner robbery, which she had nothing to do with. I mean, there's no suggestion that she was there.
Right.
He was with another woman at the time of the robbery, a woman who was charged. He says she had nothing to do with it.
Right.
Doesn't matter.
Right.
Separate case. He was with another woman at the time of the robbery. They took the proceeds. They went. Shante Smith had nothing to do with the robbery. Maybe she had some of the funds afterwards. Maybe she had access to those funds. Maybe they were in her account. Maybe she used them to bond him out.
Well, the circumstantial evidence would suggest, yes.
But the circumstance of the robbery itself, the brutality of that robbery, the prejudice and passion that flows from the facts of the robbery, forget the fact that there was a robbery. That's different from he's in jail for a crime is a whole lot different from he's in jail for a crime, and let me tell you the ugly details of those crimes, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. Those are two very different things in terms of inflaming the passions of the jury. That's what we'd suggest. Second thing follows. If I'm right about that, if you're with me there, if you go with me there, then in fact what he gets is a new trial. As he gets a new trial, if you go with me about Juror 52, or many of the other things we've argued here in this case. But even if you don't fully go to a new trial, severance was proper, fine, we'll let it go, we'll all come together. The question is, what do we do now with these death specifications? Because what I'm telling you, what I'm urging on you, is that one of the death specifications, per escape, apprehension, detection, punishment, or trial or punishment, is invalid. That the evidence simply doesn't support that specification. So we have one death specification instead of two. And what happens then? And what I want to suggest is that what happens then is that you have to send the case back. That you don't just say, well, you know, as you have said before, and I understand you've said it before many times, our independent weighing will cure whatever might have gone wrong below. And I think that's just not right.
Well, counsel, the jury did conclude, did it not, that he committed this murder to avoid detection or to facilitate his...
Yes.
In other words, the spec that you say is bogus.
Yes.
They found on the evidence
yes.
that it was present.
Yes.
So for us to agree with you procedurally, and
you have to say the jury was wrong.
You've read what I've written on these things. I don't think this is a death case. I might as well just flat out say that. I think it's just wrong as rain for this to be a death case based on what I've written previously. But for me to get there, I think I have to do it in independent weighing. Because the jury has found.
The jury has made that finding. I think the evidence doesn't support the finding. I think a Rule 29 motion on the specification should have been granted. I understand that you may not agree with me. And obviously, if you don't agree with me,
I mean,
if you don't buy any of the other...
To get where you would have this court go, don't we have to find that the jury...
On this issue, yes.
...could not find from the evidence what they found?
To get where I would have you go on the first or second or third propositions of law, the answer is yes. To say what I would... Yes, the second and third propositions of law are pendant on the first.
Isn't that almost harder than saying, based on independent weighing, we conclude this is not a death case?
You know, I would argue that on independent weighing, this is not a death case. I would happily make that argument. I don't think it is. I think what we have here is a case of, at most, a...
Well, you don't have much law to support you on that. I mean, to get the other votes that you would need.
I'm comfortable saying that. I think that what we have here, frankly, is a run-of-the-mill killing. It's a horrible crime. These are all horrible crimes. That's what we see. It's what we see. It's what they see. It's what you see every day. There are no nice killings, and these are the ones we see. These are the ones that come here. They're not all death cases, and this is frankly a brutal but run of the mill. You know what? His girlfriend was cheating on him. His girlfriend was cheating on him, and he didn't like that. And you know, so he decided he was going to take her out. Well, we don't do that. That's wrong. It's a terrible, 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 terrible thing. But, you know, but we kill people over that? Even if after he did that, he took her ATM card? Do we kill people for that? You know, I would suggest the answer to that is no. I would suggest that, in fact, one can read the record, and we've suggested this in another proposition of law. You can read the record and say he didn't kill her at all. That there is evidence that he was elsewhere when she was alive after he's supposed to have killed her.
Counsel, I don't remember all of our cases, but it seems on the robbery aspect that this is not unlike the guy down in southern Ohio who gets liquored up, goes home and has a fight with the girlfriend and kills her, and then drives her car back to the garage. And that got him death from this court.
Yeah.
So there's your problem. I mean, I dissented on that, but I
understand that the history of this court in evaluating these cases, the history of this court in evaluating these cases, has been to say, oh, well, aggravation outweighs mitigation beyond a reasonable doubt. Thank you. Over and over and over and over and over again, you have said that. It is truly the rare case where you have suggested otherwise. Very, very few. And I think, sometimes over dissent, sometimes spirited dissent, I have to say. But that has consistently been this court's take. It is your job to make those determinations. I understand that. I respectfully suggest that you have made them sometimes when you ought not have. But I think...
Counsel, one of the things that I'd like to focus on that you mentioned, that this is your run-of-the-mill killing that probably could be characterized as maybe an act of passion and response to a girlfriend cheating on him, et cetera, except there's a time lag there. He didn't kill her immediately when he got out of prison or got out of jail. She did him the courtesy of bailing him out, living with him for some days, and then his failure to appear on the 6th ends up, with his grand idea to flee the jurisdiction and facilitating that, given the downturn in their relationship is and the jury, so found that, I'm going to follow through at this point because it's expeditious to do in order to serve my ends here. So the way, it's been discussed just previously, it is not akin to someone under the influence of alcohol beating their wife or their girlfriend to death and then taking their car. This is much more horrific and calculated and self-serving.
If one reads, if in fact, the answer to that question depends in very large part on how much credibility you give to Mr. Miller, the jailhouse snitch. And we don't know, obviously, what the jury, once again, we don't peer into the minds of the individual jurors and which evidence they found compelling and which evidence they did not, we can't tell you. The evidence that he planned this while he was in jail, and there is evidence that he did, that he planned, or at least that he had the idea, the intent was formulated while he was in jail. That's what comes from Miller the snitch. And if you choose to believe that, then yes, there is a kind of long-term planning and calculus to this. It is true. There's no question that she arranged his bond. She got him out of jail. Yes, that part is certainly true. Is there that kind of long-range calculus? Well, you really do have to buy into the idea that this is what he told Miller, and that's true. If you buy that, yeah, he said a couple of weeks in advance to Miller, according to Miller, I'm going to do this, and this is why. And if you buy that, then you buy that. I think you don't have to accept that. And I think there's question about whether you ought to accept that. I think there is that continuing problem we have, we in this business, not just in Ohio, not just in this court, but nationwide, have with jailhouse snitch testimony that we know. What we know is that it is often fabricated or stretched, and that doesn't answer the question in this case, because we don't know in this case, after all. We have cross-examination, which did not lead him to break down and say, I'm lying, it's not true. Never does, apparently, except on TV. But we know that that kind of testimony is something that needs to be taken warily. And is that necessarily an accurate statement of the facts? I don't know the answer to that. I'm almost out of my time here, and I do want to save what little bit I have for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Gamzo. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Chris Anderson. I'm an assistant Lucas County prosecutor. I was trial counsel along with Tim Braun in this matter, and I'm here to argue for the state of Ohio. I'm a little concerned about Mr. Gamzo's statement that he wants 8 minutes in rebuttal. I don't know how much he has remaining. However, it would be my request to reserve some time for myself if he brings up issues that are not strictly rebuttal matters, that if he starts talking about other items that have not been...
I'm sure Mr. Gamzo does not have 8 minutes. He has about one. I don't think he has for 8 minutes. He has about 1 minute. So why don't you get on with the substance of your argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would indicate, and I'll sort of track Mr. Gamzo's argument the way he did that, and that would be, the first argument would be assignment of error or proposition of law number 6, where he indicates the jury. It would be the state's position that this clearly is in the sound discretion of the trial court. He is in a much better position to see the juror to determine whether or not her views regarding capital punishment would prevent or substantially impair her ability to be fair and impartial in this case. And he was able to do that, and I believe that that was the proper ruling, regardless of the hypothetical that was used by the court or complained about by Mr. Gamzo. We're in a situation where the juror has clearly indicated some reservations there, and I think it's within the sound discretion or purview of that judge to make that determination by whatever means necessary. I would indicate that it is kind of interesting to note that this is the only juror that they complained about in regards to this. This was not an ongoing problem. It occurred with the one juror. Therefore, to say that it had any prejudicial effect as to the 12 jurors that actually deliberated, it could not have. It was done in the individual voir dire process. No other juror heard the actual hypothetical given, and they don't complain about the jury instructions that were given to the jury as a whole. So based upon that, we'd request the court not find that this sixth proposition of law is in any way meritorious. I do also want to address the first three assignments of error. I think they are the most relevant ones that for the court to consider. We did, in fact, go back and re-indict Mr. Brinkley and then consolidated all these cases. I would indicate, though, that there is a transcript from August 31st, 2001, where the City Diner case that he was charged with was in front of Judge Wittenberg on the Lucas County Court of Common Pleas bench. That was called for pretrial after his arrest and indictment on the aggravated murder charges. There was a motion to consolidate at that point in time. Mr. Brinkley was, in fact, represented by Attorney Dave Klukas. He did not oppose and agree to the consolidations of the matter to be in front of Judge Jensen for that purpose. I know it doesn't negate that they then, in fact, did file motions to sever those counts. But I submit to the court that you could not try the aggravated murder of Shantae Smith without bringing up the evidence of the City Diner robbery.
Why?
Because they are interrelated so much so that you couldn't do that. The first fact is, and I can go through a great deal of facts here, is the City Diner robbery, and to digress just a little bit about the aspect that Mr. Brinkley did this in the heat of passion because she was cheating on him, is that he was with a prostitute the evening before. They then go over to the City Diner where he worked and then robbed the City Diner after sitting in that...
I understand all that, but why do you have to have that in the...
Because they actually take the proceeds of the robbery. There were about $2,200 that were taken. $800 was found on Grady Brinkley. $400 was found on the prostitute that he was with. They went and gave a purse, the orange purse that was taken from the robbery, and gave it to someone, an old elderly gentleman at 826 Junction where Shantae Smith was living. She then got the proceeds and opened a bank account shortly thereafter.
So you proved to the jury that she was a co-conspirator in the robbery.
And a better after the fact, yes. And she received proceeds of that robbery. And that he was then arrested for that robbery. She's visiting him in jail, and she's collecting money into that account. And as soon as the account gets to be $2,000, she then goes to a bail bondsman to post the 10% to get him out. It took her till December 17th to get the $2,000 amount, but she was then the one who procured the bond person and actually signed on the bond with the defendant in this particular case to get him out of jail for that robbery. He was then supposed to appear in front of Judge Wittenberg on the City Diner robbery on January 6th. It's within hours, at least 24 hours, that the murder of this person occurred. Whether he knew it or not, we had testimony from the bailiff that when he failed to appear on the 6th, there was a warrant for his arrest that then occurred, and that he then fled on the 7th. We also know that he also called, from the phone records, that he called the Greyhound bus station on January 6th in an effort to make arrangements to get a bus ticket to get out of town on the date he was supposed to appear.
Counsel, help me get to the point where I could conclude death is appropriate for this person. I'm not really interested in talking about killing her to escape detection or to flee the jurisdiction, because I'm not persuaded by that, but the jury found that. So if I disagree with that, do I have to, let's leave the robbery aside, because that's what I want to talk about. That's what's troubling to me. Say the robbery hadn't occurred, but if I disagreed with the jury's conclusion here, wouldn't it be more appropriate for me to just say, based on my independent weighing, I think this is not a death case, or do I have to go whole hog and say the jury just couldn't possibly have found that on this evidence?
I guess I'm somewhat confused by your question, because I don't think there's any way I can convince you to impose death penalty on any case. But
counsel,
if you're gonna
you demean my understanding of the statute, and you apparently haven't read all the cases that I've written in which we have imposed death.
I've read some of them, but I will acknowledge I haven't read all of them, and I apologize. Okay. I don't mean any disrespect for the court.
No, I thought you just said I wouldn't impose death on anybody, which wouldn't be true. But let me take you to the robbery side. Do you have an opinion, if a justice sitting here looks at this and says, I just don't see how you can find there was enough evidence to make that conclusion on this escape part, do we have to conclude the jury just wasn't offered enough or not?
No, I think there is enough, in strictly in the aggravated robbery of Shante Smith, when he strangled her and then cut her throat and then took her ATM card.
Okay, I understand that. And there, that's the part of the case with which I have an ongoing problem with the application of the death penalty. I realize that fits definitionally, but it continues to trouble me where the robbery appears to be an afterthought.
See,
and we see those cases with some degree of regularity. Let's forget the ATM card for a moment and say it's just the coat. Would you say you ought to get death? I assume the coat was specified in the charge for taking a coat that didn't fit after he killed her.
Right. It was part of the totality of the circumstance of the case, because we clearly have pictures shown of him wearing that coat trying to access a bank account. In fact, I disagree with the defense when they say we don't have a photograph of him, because he actually leans in and you can see his face.
I guess my point and my question is that I truly believe the legislature, when they enacted this, and they, when it's the felony murder part of it as applies to robbery and that kind of thing, is thinking about the person who goes into a bank, as happened here in Columbus recently, goes into the filling station with the gun to commit a robbery, and things go awry and they kill someone. But they went in there to commit the robbery. And the cases in which the taking of something of value appears to be perhaps incidental or an afterthought after the murder.
I understand what you're coming.
And so my question is there anything here that would indicate he took the purpose of the murder was to facilitate the taking of the ATM card
or the
coat?
You have to look at the totality of the circumstances, and it goes back to the Rick City Diner robbery in regards to that, because initially the plan was that after they did the robbery, they were going to go to the bus station. He was going to leave then right after the robbery, because everybody at that robbery knew who he was, and he was going to make his escape right then and there by going back to Chicago to the bus station. He changed his mind and went back to a crack house. Unfortunately for him, he did the robbery at shift change at the police department, and so when the call came in, they had about 5 directed patrol units waiting for him to come out of the crack house. He was apprehended almost right away. So he was going to flee. He told Samuel Miller in the jail that I'm just going to keep her real calm until she buys me out. I'm not going to, but I'm, as soon as I do that, I'm going to kill her and I'm going to flee the jurisdiction. And so he had planned to do this from the very beginning. He used, but he needed the money to do that. And he knew the account because she opened the account with the money from the proceeds that he had gotten from the City Diner. And that was the exact same account that he then tried to access when he left. But he killed her before he robbed her because
so
he didn't have the PIN number.
He took the card so he could steal his own money?
Well, I don't know if he thought it was still his money. Maybe he thought it was. Obviously, she kept putting in money also, but he gave her $850. $2,000 of it went for the bond. So obviously, we would argue that any of his money from ill-gotten goods went to the bond. He wanted the rest of it. But it's all interrelated. Clearly, if we had taken this case, the city diner stuff would have been admissible pursuant to 404B. As other evidence. Plus, it was simple and direct testimony where you could separate it out to where the joinder of the offense is appropriate. The prosecutor's office is now in a bind based upon some of the not really a bind, maybe that's maybe the wrong word, but we're very cognizant of what this court is telling us. And you've criticized the prosecutors in the past because you basically say you're putting up non-statutory aggravating circumstances, the Rogenstahl violations. And so if we had presented this evidence as to the Rick City Diner without this specification in there, and it is admissible pursuant to 404B and the joinder motions, you would come back to us and say, well, you're arguing non-statutory aggravating circumstances. So we're required to basically put a specification on these on this conduct based upon it is provable under the statute. For them to argue then bad faith on our part for doing that.
Couldn't you have just tried him, if you want death, for the theft of the ATM card?
They're interrelated. It shows the character and why this person deserves more so than the normal run-of-the-mill murderers, they refer to it. That not only did he kill her and steal her ATM card, but he actually had robbed before, and he was doing this all because he's not going to be caught. He's not going to be prosecuted for this because he doesn't deserve it. And when you get back to the weighing circumstances that you talked about, let's say you just had the one robbery of Shantae Smith as a specification. And you go in your independent way and you're saying, well, that's the aggravating circumstance. Well, what are the mitigating factors? Well, the mitigating factors were just his family coming in there. But there's actually absolutely no mitigating circumstances because this defendant got up and in his unsworn statement to the jury said that they all lied, that none of it was true. And therefore, there was absolutely no mitigating factors in regards to this case. So when you go back and do your independent review, you have nothing on that side of the scale. And therefore, death is the appropriate sentence here. I don't know if you want to go through all the other assignments of error or propositions of law that are set forth in the brief by the appellant. I will address any one of those that the court feels relevant. I think, though, that it was appropriate for us to have presented that specification as to the trial. They're not alleging that that specification is unconstitutional. I believe that based upon the law that this state has, that there was sufficient evidence that sustained or supported that conviction and the jury's verdict was appropriate and proper.
I have just a question on the judges. One of the items, proposition of law, was the judges going back and talking to the jury. Now, I realize that both sides were apprised that he was going to do that, but as an independent weigher of the mitigating circumstances, could that not be a bad influence and a bad practice?
It's probably a bad practice, but I don't believe that it's worthy of reversal at this point in time. The jurors actually had been discharged, so he wasn't actually talking to jurors. Judges in almost every case go back and talk to the jurors afterwards, thank them for their service, and answer any questions the jurors may have. I don't think they actually didn't talk about sentence in every case. So maybe it's something the judges should not do in every case. But I don't believe, other than the innuendo that's referred to in the appellant's brief, that it did affect the judge's decision in this case.
So I take it there's nothing in the record indicating that they discussed the mitigating factors versus the aggravating factors?
No. I don't believe it was on the record. I think he was just basically thanking them for their service like they normally do and having some interaction with them after they're discharged. Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose they could have gotten possibly juror stuff. I don't even think the Allende rule would apply because they've been discharged as jurors at that point. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I'll take my leave. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Gamzo, you've saved us a little over 1 minute of your time.
Thank you. Very quickly. Look, what I'm suggesting about the purpose of independent weighing is this, that I believe is that independent weighing sits in the statute as a protection for the defendant, not a protection for the state. That it is not there so that when the state overreaches, when the evidence is wrong, that you can go back and say, oh, well, they would have killed him anyway. That's what you said in Brooks. We can't look into the minds of the individual jurors. And I think that's right. You can't do that. On the other hand, when you see that the jury overreached, that the record, that the trial judge overreached. That's where the independent weighing comes in to cure those. It's protection for the defendant, not protection for the state. Mr. Anderson said they had to put in the A3 specification, because otherwise, when they brought in the evidence about Rick's City Diner, we would have been standing up here today saying, well, these are non-statutory aggravating circumstances. In other words, we used the specification as the excuse to get in the evidence of Rick's City Diner. All I'm saying is that the evidence of the crime itself is a different story. The fact of it is different. And finally, I have no more time to finish the last couple of things I was going to say. I want to thank you and ask you to reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Gamzo. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise.